Okay. We'll try to cover as many short topics from the Sedra. First, something that I think we spoke about in the past in Bereshis, but it's kedai to speak about now and apply it to what is relevant to Shmos. It says by Moshe Rabbeinu that when he was born, so Batirehu Kito, she saw he was good, and therefore Batitzbeneu Shloshe Yerochim, she hid him for 3 months. Now there are all kinds of Midrashim that she saw that he was born Mohul, that he was circumcised. She saw the light. Kitov refers to the light. Bayar Lokima Sa'or Kitov. She saw the light of the Shechina with him. And therefore, she had a feeling that she could hide him for 3 months and everything would be okay. Special child. But what's the simple meaning? Every pasuk has to have a simple meaning too, not just medrashim that are not inherent in the simple meaning of the pasuk. And the simple meaning doesn't seem to make any sense. Because it seems to imply that the only reason she hid him because she saw he was good. But if he wasn't good, she wouldn't have hid him. Now why did she hide him? Because if she didn't hide him, the Egyptians would come and drown him. So imagine a mother looking at the kid and saying, hey, this kid's not a bad little kid, so let's hide him so he won't get drowned. But if he was a little brat, right, crying all the time, she would say, you know, Egyptians, come and drown this poor kid. Right? No tachlis in hiding him. So what's the simple meaning of the pasuk? Batireu kitov. Says the Rashbam, at least the way I understand it, the following. Moshe Rabbeinu was born 3 months premature. And usually a baby 3 months premature, even today with all modern medicine, has a very slim chance of surviving. In those days, probably didn't have too much of a chance to survive altogether. Hiding a Jewish baby was a crime punishable by death for the whole family. It's like what the Nazis did, right? Part of the Nuremberg laws were that Jewish women couldn't have children. And if you were caught having a child and the mother was killed, then the entire family, whoever harbored or hid a Jew, was also liable to a death penalty. So it would mean putting the entire family into danger if hiding that child was ever discovered. On the other hand, putting the family in danger was only a doubtful thing. The baby's danger was immediate, so you'd be allowed to do that. However, if the child was not viable, and he wasn't going to exist anyway, so then how can you put a family in danger for a child who's probably not going to exist anyway? But that's what it says. Vatireu ki tov. The word tov does not necessarily mean good. It means good. But it means good only because good is what is substantive in this world, what's real. That's what's good. And what is bad really doesn't exist. It's just a figment of our imagination. God created it in order that we should have free choice. But it's really not a substantive thing. So tov means something that has the ability to continue to exist. Where do we see this in Bereishis? It says that the Ribbono Shel Olam said, let there be fish. And then it says, Vayara Elokim ki tov. God looked at it and he saw it was good. Now, in first grade, you're allowed to understand that simply, that God said, let there be fish. Then he took a look at it and said, hey, not bad. I mean, looks like fish. You know, good, pretty good. Pat himself on the back. You know, looks pretty good. That's absurd. The Ribbono Shel Olam knew exactly what he was making. There was no chance of it being different than he wanted. He didn't have to look at it and see that it was good. What does that mean? Says the Ramban, what it means is the following. God wills things into being, whatever that means. But in our terms, he speaks, hu amar vayehi. He speaks and that brings things into existence, in our way of describing it. But once God wills something into existence, what gives it the power to continue to exist? So then God looks at it. And when he looks at it, his looking at it makes it then be able to continue to exist and to reproduce itself, whatever it needs for continued existence. So the idea of tov, ki tov means it has continued existence. That's Tov. That's why the ultimate Tov is Torah, because that's eternal. Mein Tov v'le Torah. Haudu Hashem ki Tov, ki li'olam chasdo. Since God's kindness is forever, it's Tov. That's why the Gemara says that the word Tov didn't appear in the first Luchos, because they were going to be broken. They weren't going to exist. But in the second Luchos, it says, L'man yarichun yomecha v'yitav loch. L'man yitav loch. It should be good for you. Those words aren't in the first Luchos, because they were broken. So Tov doesn't apply to them.
Which implies that the Luchos were destined to be broken
before they were given. Yeah, all these kind of things are, the Rabban Shom ultimately knows what's going to be, but we only know about it after the fact, and he only deals with it after the fact. But after the fact, yeah. In any case, so therefore, over here what it says is, she saw that he was viable. Because if he wasn't viable, she wouldn't have hit him, because she wouldn't have been allowed to put the entire family into danger. But she saw he was viable, therefore she was permitted to hide him and put the family in a doubtful danger and save this child from a definite, immediate danger. Okay. Next, it says in the same pasuk, Vayigdal Hayeled, concerning Moshe Rabbeinu, the child grew up, and then it says Vayigdal Moshe. So the Ramban explains the first one is physically. He physically grew up, he physically matured. The second one is Vayigdal Moshe, he spiritually, emotionally matured, a mature adult. What signified the line of demarcation between an immature person and a mature adult? What was the criteria to know that Moshe became a gadol? Vayigdal Moshe. So the idea of gadol is somebody who cares about other people. How do I know that? Because it says in the pasuk, Vayigdal Moshe, Vayetze Alechov, he went out to his brethren, right? And Vayar v'siglosom, he saw their suffering. Rashi says, Nosan eino v'libo lios meitzrali. Put his heart and his mind to suffer with them. That is a sign of godliness, of a god. A child is concerned only about himself, me, what he can get. It says the person is born in this world with his fists clenched. Everything is for himself. And the stage of immaturity is everything the child is concerned about is only himself. A sign of maturity is when we begin to worry about other people too. One second, we'll see why that's called godless. That's called godless. And that's why at the end of life, the last thing the Chevra Kadisha does in preparing a body for burial is to open, if the hands are clenched, to open them up. At least you should leave this world with an open hand. You may come into the world with a closed hand. You're only concerned about yourself. At least you leave, open your hand to others. Okay, that's the sign of maturity. My son-in-law, Rabbi Brinus, who's the of wife of Chala fame, he told me once an interesting thing. He said, why it says that the Mo'or HaGadol is the sun, and the Mo'or HaKatan is the moon. The moon is a katan because it only receives, doesn't give. The sun gives out, therefore it's a gadol. That's the Mo'or HaGadol. In any case, why is that? Why is godless, right? What?
The sun only gives, the moon receives.
If it doesn't give anything, it gives only what it receives.
It
reflects, yeah. Right. But it doesn't really give out anything. It only reflects what it gets. The why is that called the gadol? So I always like to say it's based on what Reb Shimon Shkop says in his preface to one of his svarim. He says there the following. He says that there's always a conflict between self-concern and concern for other people. On the one hand, the Torah legitimizes or even condones, or even more than condones, promotes self-concern. You come first in almost every area. For instance, the Gemara says if you only have a certain amount of money and you need charity and somebody else needs charity, you take the money for yourself. If something is getting lost, right? Let's take an example. You left your car on a hill, and you forgot to put on the emergency brake, and it's rolling to oblivion. And your father's or mother's car have the same thing. They're both rolling to oblivion. You can jump into one of them and stop and save the car. Right? It's a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, okay? Because the thing is going to be lost. Whose do you save? Your father's and mother's or your own? Or your Rebbe, right? You save your own. That's Allah. Avedos Chako, you come first. After that, when you're not involved personally, then there's a Shiloh. Your parents come first, your Rebbe comes first, or whatever. But if you're involved and you can only save one of them, you save your own. Classic case, person's in the desert, he has a jug of water that he will be able to survive, and if he shares it with his friend, both of them will die. If he gives it to the other person, he'll live and he'll die. Who that gets it? Person who owns it. You come first. Chayecha kodem, v'chayochicha imach. So self-concern is a legitimate concern, even mandated by the Torah. Yet we're not supposed to be only concerned about ourselves. We're supposed to be concerned about other people too. So how do you balance, how do you resolve this conflict between self-concern and concern for others? That's his question. He says that really the conflict is only great if you consider yourself from your toes to your head and everything else is somebody else. Yeah, it's a big conflict. Me or all those other people out there. He said, but some people are bigger than that, and they don't consider themselves just from their toes to their head, but they consider their spouse part and parcel of themselves, as the Torah Gemara says. Ishto kegufo, a wife is mamish like the body of the husband, and the husband is like an extension of the wife. Baal ke ishto. So a husband and wife are supposed to be, like the Chazon Ish says, the relationship between a husband and wife is supposed to be like the right hand to the left hand. It doesn't say which is the right, which is the left, but in any case, it doesn't make a difference, really. So, it depends if you're a lefty, too. In any case, like a right hand to a left hand. It's all one entity. So a person like that, right, when he's concerned about his spouse, or she's concerned about her spouse, they're not concerned about somebody else. It's self-concern. It's just their self-concern is two bodies. Some people are bigger than that, and they realize their children are extensions of themselves. And when they're concerned about their children, they're concerned about themselves. It's not self-concern. It's not concern for somebody else. Some people are bigger than that, and they consider their entire extended family. Ach atzmi ubesoriata, as Lavan said. Now, you're my flesh and blood, right? So he didn't mean it, but he meant it, what's it called, that, you know...
I can kill you.
Right, I can do whatever I want to you. But some people really feel that their extended family is flesh and blood. So when they're concerned about their aunts, uncles, cousins, right, nephews and nieces, they're not concerned about somebody else. That's self-concern. Some people realize that their entire neighborhood is part of them. So when they're concerned about their neighborhood, they're concerned about themselves. Some people, the whole city. Some people, the whole country. Some people, all of Klal Yisrael, or all the world. So somebody who really feels that everyone is part of him, so it's all self-concern. So then it's just a matter of priority. Which part of me right now is the one that has to be addressed? But it's not a question of me or them. It's a question of which part of me. Now, that sounds like semantics because you still have the same conflict. Is it this part of me or that part of me? Right? There's a very big difference. I think we mentioned this a few weeks ago. When Yaakov Avinu was looking for a rock to use as a pillow, So there were 12 rocks that seemed to be able to fit the bill. So they all were, I guess, the size of his head. That could be a pillow. They weren't little pebbles and they weren't gigantic things. So they were fighting. Who is the tzaddik going to put his head on? So the Rabbanu Shel Olam fused them all together and that solved the problem. Says the Chiddush Yerim, why did it solve the problem? Yaakov's head didn't get any bigger and the stones didn't get any smaller. So now you have one gigantic rock 12 times the size of Yaakov's head. His head's only going to rest on 1/12 of that stone. Why isn't the stone still fighting? Which part of the stone is he going to put his head on? The answer is once it's one stone, it doesn't make a difference. It's all one stone. What difference does it make? It's part of that part. When you consider yourself separate from everybody else, then there's a big conflict. Should I worry about myself or worry about those people out there? But when you consider yourself and everybody one entity, and it's only a matter of priority, it's not the same conflict. It's not the same conflict. What does that mean to feel somebody else part of you? It means to empathize with someone, to feel their pain, to know what they need, right? This famous story of two drunks that are in a bar, totally drunk, and one of them says to the other one, "Do you love me?" And the other drunk says, "Yeah, I love you." He says, "Do you really love me?" He said, "Yeah, I really love you." He says, "Do you know what I need then?" He said, "No." He says, "How can you really love me? You don't know what I need. If you really love me, you'd know, you'd feel what I feel." So that's the level. That's called Nosei Ba'olim Chaveiro. Somebody who carries somebody else's load. It doesn't only mean bad. It means you feel their tzar when they have tzaris, and you feel their simcha when you're the simcha. It's like your simcha. That's a level where a person can actually feel empathy for somebody else, right? For the good or for the bad, feel mamish like somebody else. But for that, you need two things. Like that was Moshe Rabbeinu. Vayar b'sivlosam. Vayar doesn't necessarily mean he saw. He experienced. He understood. That's what Rashi says, Nosan Eino Velibo, his eyes and his heart. Eyes mean your intellect. In order to really empathize with somebody, you have to know what they're going through. You have to know what they need. You have to know what their tsar is all about. If you don't understand it intellectually, you can do a person terrible harm out of concern for them, out of misplaced empathy. A drug addict comes to you and begs you to give him money so he can go buy drugs. That's misplaced empathy if you give him the money. The best thing to do is to try to convince him to get off the drugs and to go to a rehab. I'll pay for a rehab. I'm not going to pay for drugs. So sometimes if you don't have seichel, if you don't have the eyes, you can do people harm by thinking that you don't understand what they really need. On the other hand, if you only understand intellectually what people need, but you don't have a heart and you don't feel it emotionally, you'll do nothing about it. You'll make a study, there'll be a study about poverty. But I won't do anything about it, though. So you need a heart and you need eyes, too. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu did. He put his eyes and his heart to feel their pain. And therefore, he says, that's what it means in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Im ein ani li mili. If I'm not for myself, who's going to be for me? I have to worry about myself. Self-concern is mandated by the Torah. But kishani li atzmi, when my me is just little me, from my head to my toes, that's not my ani. That's not my real me. The real me includes everybody. And I think there's a hint in the word ani that hints to that. The word ani has an aleph on the right side, which is an individual, the individual person. And the left side is a yud. Yud is a minion, is ten, is representative of the community, of everybody else out there. So how do you take the aleph and the yud and combine them to be your ani, to be your ego, your person? You have a nun. The nun is 50. There's 50 gates of wisdom, and there are 50 gates of purity. You need a lot of wisdom and a lot of emotion, pure emotion, to be able to take the individual and the community and make them one. That's ani. That's kishani liatzmi. That's what the ani is. So that's why it makes how much a person feels for others and identifies with the pain and the simcha of other people, what kind of gadol he is. Because if he can't empathize and feel other people, or he can only do it in a small way, so he's less big. The more he can empathize with more people, the bigger a person he is. So that's why the godless, by Yigdal Moshe, depends both from a maturity standpoint, but also from an actual standpoint. You're a bigger person, because you identify with more people than just your little self. That's why Vayigdal Moshe. Okay. Chazal say that Yosef was zoche to be buried in Eretz Yisrael because Hoda Be'arzo. Because when he was taken out of prison, he told Paro, or he told the Saramashkin, right, Ki gunov gunavti me'eretz ha'ivrim. I was kidnapped and stolen out of my birthplace, Eretz ha'ivrim, the land of the Jews, Eretz Yisrael. I am not an Egyptian. My roots are in Eretz Yisrael. So he admitted to his roots. On the other hand, Moshe Rabbeinu was not zoche to be buried in Eretz Yisrael for many reasons. But one reason was lo holda bi'artzo. He didn't admit to his roots. When was that? This week's Sedra, Benos Yisro, I come home early, because every day they have to, the shepherds push them away from the well and take the water first, and they have to wait till last, right? And today, Moshe Rabbeinu pushed the shepherds away and gave them to take for their sheep first, and they came home early. So Yisro said, how'd you get home early today? Right? They said, because Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian man, saved us. So, seemingly, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say, I'm sorry, but I'm not an Ish Mitzri, I'm an Ish Ivri. He didn't say that, because he didn't admit to his roots, right? Therefore, he wasn't buried in Eretz Yisrael. Very big problem, though. Moshe wasn't there. How do I know? Because the next pasuk says, the Ayo, where is he? I mean, where is he? Standing right here. Listen. So, obviously, in here. Right? Maybe. What? Oh, wait. One second. But so it can't be that he heard himself being called a Mitzri and didn't protest. Because he didn't hear himself hearing being a Mitzri. He wasn't there. You may be able to say he was standing outside the tent. He heard, but Yisrael didn't see him. Maybe. Right? Because he said, go out and call him. My master had to go out and call him. He was out of earshot. They didn't say, okay, come in, you know, what's it called? So, where was the hold of the answer? Beyond that, it's even more difficult. Yosef was born in Eretz Israel. So he was stolen from his native country, right? And he's not an Ish Mitzri. But Moshe Rabbeinu was born in Egypt. Why was he an Ish Ivri? Why should he be molded that of Eretz Israel is his native land? It's not. He was born in Egypt. So on that, the pasuk says, "Ish ish." The Gemara says in Ksubas that talking about in the future, the Goyim are going to glorify Jews, especially the inhabitants of Yerushalayim, and ish ish, double, both those that were born in Yerushalayim and those that always wanted to be there but weren't able to be, they're considered also like citizens of Yerushalayim, of Eretz Israel. And this, the Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, permitted what on the surface appeared to be a falsehood. In the wake of right before World War I, so the Turks were expelling from Eretz Israel all aliens, anyone who came from Europe or whatever, because they were anticipating, they were part of the Axis over there, it wasn't called the Axis, whatever it was. And they were expelling anybody who wasn't born in Eretz Israel from Eretz Israel. They were the control of, Turkey was in control of Eretz Israel. So people came to Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and wanted to know, were they allowed to lie and say they were born there? So there wasn't a lot of documentation, you know, and they went pretty much on what people said or what false documents they could forge to say they were born here in order not to be expelled from the land. It was a tremendous loss of money, of everything. So Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld said that not only somebody who's born in Eretz Yisrael is considered a native of Eretz Yisrael, but anybody who was born in Chutz La'aretz but wanted to come here, and obviously if you ended up coming here, you wanted to be here, so he's also considered, the Pasuk says, considered as if he was, as if he's a native. So it's not a lie. You can say it. You can say that you were born here, even if you weren't, because the Torah considers you, Pasuk considers you like that, so it's not a lie, based on the Pasuk. In any case, so Moshe Rabbeinu, and that we could say, since every Jew, the real place where they belong is in Eretz Yisrael, and the fact that they're born in Galus is only a accident of our free choice that we ended up in Galus, so we ended up in Galus Mitzrayim, but really should have been in Eretz Yisrael, and everybody's hoping to go back and wants to be there, so really you're a Israeli, wherever you are, right? You're a Ben Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so that we can answer. The Moshe Rabbeinu, right, really should have been molded. I don't belong here. I really, even though I was born here, this is not really my country. My country is Eretz Yisrael. But he wasn't there. He didn't say it. Why in the world is he accused or held guilty because they called him a Mitzri and he didn't admit to where he wasn't there. He didn't know. The answer, I think, is very simple. And that is somebody who you could think was a Mitzri. He looked like he fit in with the rest of Egyptian culture, even Moshe Rabbeinu, right? If the Benos Yisro could think that that's where he fit in, then something wrong with Moshe Rabbeinu. A Jew should stand out. This is not, he's something different. He's not the run-of-the-mill, he's not just a plain American. There's something special about him. There's something different about him. If a Jew doesn't exude that difference, that Klal Yisrael are different, right? We're not just the run-of-the-mill American, British, whatever you may be, right? But we represent something different, right? We have a different lifestyle. We perhaps dress differently. It says that the Jews didn't dress like the Egyptians totally, at least in those areas where dressing like an Egyptian represented Egyptian culture, right? Not necessarily they didn't wear the same clothing as the Egyptians, but there's certain clothing that represent the culture of the place that they didn't wear. Clothing that was immodest, or clothing that represented idolatry, or whatever. Right? They didn't follow every fad. They dressed. You could see. Looks like a Jew. Doesn't look like a regular run-of-the-mill Egyptian. They didn't talk like the Egyptians. Right? Loshinu is Lashonam. Doesn't necessarily mean they spoke Hebrew, but they spoke in a way that you could see a regular Egyptian doesn't speak like that. Right, whatever. Whatever they not the gender of the language, but the surah of the language, and they didn't change their names. You could see that's a Jew, right? In any case, so if the daughters of Yisroel could mistake Moshe Rabbeinu for a Mitzri, then something is missing in his at that point in Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore his bond to the land wasn't as strong as it could be, and therefore for the other reasons why he wasn't buried in Eretz Yisrael, they overpowered. And he had that tremendous bond, they couldn't have broken that bond. But since the bond was weak, it could be broken by other reasons why he had to be buried in Chutz Laaretz. Okay. Next. It says, Vayoel Moshe Lasheves Es Ha'ish. Vayol means he began to live. He got married to Tzipora, Yisro's daughter, and he began to live with Yisro. So the word Vayol also signifies an oath, Allah. And Allah is an oath. So the Medrash says that when he began to live with Yisro, he took an oath. Yisro made him take an oath. You want to live here? There's one condition. Your firstborn child will be dedicated to idolatry. You accept that condition, fine. Not. And the truth is, in the end, that's what happened, right? Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson, the son of Gershon, was Pesel Micha, was the Levi who ministered to Pesel Micha later on in Sefer Shoftim. So the obvious question is, how in the world could Moshe Rabbeinu take such an oath that his firstborn would go to Avodah Zarah? What kind of oath was that? It was all different. What's it called? The explanations. Yisro thought he agreed to it. Moshe never agreed to it. Yisro fooled himself into thinking that Moshe agreed. The Michtam Elio says the following. The Maral says whenever it says somebody took an oath, it doesn't mean that they said, I swear. The purpose of an oath is to show that you really mean what you're saying and are committed to it. So if somebody is committed to something, it's as if they took an oath. Even though they didn't say, I swear. Moshe Rabbeinu realized that Hashpas Hasviva, the environmental, influence, is very, very strong. And living with Yisro, who was not yet a believer in one God, he was still, had his journeys to idolatry, to decide what the truth was. He still was searching. What?
The daughters come through out of water because Yisro was already in Yidu by God forgiving Ephah.
Yeah, because he gave up the guise of Midian, but he still was searching for the others. When did he become Ata Yadati? After Kriyas Yamsuf, before Matan Torah. That's when he came to his conclusion. So, living in such an environment is dangerous. Right? It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be influenced, but there's a strong, strong power of environmental influence. And Moshe Rabbeinu may have felt that he could withstand it. His wife could withstand it, okay? But a child growing up in that situation may not be able to. So when you make a decision, I'm going to stay in this situation, knowing that this is a possibility. I'm hoping that I'll be able to avoid it. I'm hoping it won't come out to that. But I know that accepting this decision means that this is also a possibility. It's as if you agreed to that possibility also. Because once you agreed to put yourself in this situation, so you agreed with all the baggage that may come along with it. You're hoping it won't come, but it is a possibility. Once it's a possibility, even if it's not a probability, then by saying, I accept this decision, then you accept all the ramifications of what the decision could possibly be. So that's what it means. By putting himself in that situation, it's as if he said, I'm giving my child over to Avodah Zarah because I know that is a possibility. I'm hoping it won't happen. I'm hoping I'll be able to avoid it. But I know that by putting myself in this situation, that is one possibility, and it means I accept that possibility too. That's what it means. Okay, let's go on. It says that when Moshe Rabbeinu saw the Malach, or the representation of God's presence in the fire of the snare, he covered his face with his hands because he was afraid to look at this apparition, this representation of God's presence or an angel. So there are two opinions in the Gemara what the result of that was. One says he was rewarded for that. It was a very modest and humble reaction. I'm not fit to look even at an angel. So he covered his face. So in that schus, in the merit that he was so modest and humble, later on, his face shone with the glory of the Shechina. Koran or Panav. After Matan Torah, second Matan Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain, his face, he had to put a mask on because people couldn't look at him. There's another opinion in the Gemara. He was punished for that. And because he covered his face, later on when Moshe asked to see God's glory, God said to him, "Kishiratzisi lo ratzisa." When I wanted to show you my glory in the snare, you didn't want to look. Afshav shatero, now you want to see it, I don't want to show you. So first of all, very difficult to say that there could be an argument from one extreme to the other. Arguments are usually contained that one says he got rewarded, one said he didn't get rewarded. One said he got punished, one said he didn't get punished. But for one to say he got rewarded for the same thing the other one said he got punished is very, very polarized argument. You don't find usually arguments like that. It's called minakotza lakotza, from one extreme to the other. Secondly, it doesn't sound like God. It sounds like, you know, a six-year-old Spidey. Well, when I wanted to show you, you don't want to look. Now you want to look, I don't want to show you. That's how God functions. So I was thinking that everybody agrees that Moshe Rabbeinu was rewarded for covering his face. That's not the question. That everybody agrees to. He got a reward for being humble and modest and covering his face. He wasn't on the level to look, and he understood that, and he got rewarded for that. What he got punished for was not for covering his face. Listen to the words. Kishiratzisi lo ratzisa. When I wanted to show you, you didn't want to look. Not you didn't look. You didn't want to look. Now that you want, I don't want to show you. Meaning the following. Moshe Rabbeinu should have covered his face. But he should have had a tremendous desire. When will come the day that I'll be on the level that I could look? But he didn't care. Covered his face and that was it. He wasn't interested in it. When people don't have a desire for something, then they never reach that goal. Had you wanted then, today you'd be on the level to be able to see. But since you didn't want it then, you only can reach levels that you desire and aspire towards. But had you aspired from that point on, you would have reached the level to be able to see now. You didn't aspire from that point on, you haven't reached a level. Therefore, I don't want to show you. It's an impossibility. That's the idea. Kishiratzisi lo ratzisa. When I wanted, you didn't want. Not that you didn't look. You didn't look, you got rewarded for not looking. But you should have wanted to look. That's the idea. I heard a story. I once said this in Los Angeles. And Rabbi Uri Zatzal, he was the head of the Board of Education there in Los Angeles. He brought me in there to speak at a chinuch day they had in the city. So I said this over. And he told me a maisa He said that that he heard from Rabbi Schwab. Rabbi Schwab spent what he learned in Mir, even though he came from Germany, but he was fair and sent him to Mir to learn, which was a long distance away. So he never went home, you know, Ben Azman. He went home once a year. Once a year, Pesach, he went home. So one year, the Mir Mashgiach, Rabbi Yeruchim Levovitz, sees that Rabbi Schwab isn't packing. You know, it's already Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and he's not packing to go home. It's one time a year journey home for Pesach. So he called him over, and he said, why aren't you getting ready to go home? He said, I don't have the money to make the trip, and my parents were supposed to send it. Someone never got here. I don't have the money to go, so I guess I'm going to have to stay here. He said, no way. You have to go home to your parents at least once a year. He said, I'll loan you the money. I'm sure your parents, you know, intended to send it or whatever, and if they did and they got lost, they'll send more. So when you come back, you'll pay me back the debt. Your parents will send the money with you. But you have to go home. So he loaned him the money. He went home for Pesach. He came back, and sure enough, parents sent the money to pay back the loan. So he gives back the money, and he says, thank you. He says, no, you're not allowed to say thank you. Because it's ribis devarim. You can't say thank you for a loan because you're adding something to the payback, an extra thank you. That's called interest. So you can't do that. It's ribis devarim. So he told him, no, you're not allowed to say thank you. And taught him halacha that you pay back a loan, you don't say thank you. The next year, the same thing happened. The money never came through. The Bruchim loaned him the money to go home. Comes back, gives him the money, and this year he's careful, doesn't ever say a word. Bruchim looks at him and says, where's my thank you? He said, Rabbi, I don't understand. Last year I said thank you, you gave it to me. This year I didn't say thank you, you give it to me again. He says, no, I don't want you to say thank you. But at least I want you to see that you wanted to say thank you, right? That, you're not allowed to, right? But at least you should want to say thank you for the loan. The halacha says you can't do it. I don't even see you wanted to say thank you. That's something wrong already. Okay, same idea over here. Okay, next. The Rav Amishon appears to Moshe Rabbeinu in the burning bush, and he tells him that you have been chosen to be the redeemer of the Jewish people. Okay, so you have a mission, get to it. What does Moshe Rabbeinu say? I don't think, God, you made a good choice. Mi anochi, who am I that I should go to Paro? And the Chiyotzi, and are Bnei Yisrael really fit to be redeemed? I don't think so. I don't think I'm fit, and I don't think they're fit. So it's really a misfit over here. I think you're a bad choice. Now, you could say that Moshe Rabbeinu was being humble. But I say he's being chutzpahdik. What kind of ridiculous thing is this? God says, you know, I've really researched this thing. I pretty much know people, right? And I decided you're the one to go. And I decided the Jewish people are ready to be redeemed. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, I hate to disagree with you, God, but I don't think so. What kind of chutzpah is that? Who are you disagreeing with? I mean, if anything, God should have turned around and said, look, I'm God. I told you this. But don't argue with me. I know a lot better than you know. Why does the Rav Amishon doesn't get angry at him? He answers him, no, why are you? I'll be with you. Right? The Jewish people will receive the Torah. I'm doing it on credit. And then Moshe Rabbeinu asks other questions. Well, okay, I'm going to go. They're going to ask me, what's your name? Then he says, well, you know, I can't talk. So I don't think I'm the right one. I'm not a speaker. God said, what are you talking about? Who made people speak? Right? And so on and so on. Right? Until Moshe Rabbeinu says, you know, send my brother, because I think he's going to feel bad. I think he's going to be slighted that you passed over him. He's my older brother. He was the one that you used as the messenger to deal with the Jewish people as a prophet all this time in Egypt. And now the big job comes and you give it to the little brother and you pass over to the big brother. I think he's going to be hurt. Then God gets angry at him. Right? You lost the Kohen. You should have been the Kohen and Aaron should have been the Levi. Now you're going to be the Levi and Aaron's going to be the Kohen because you said this. Now, if you ask me, that was the nicest thing that Moshe Rabbeinu said. All the other things, right, trying to get out of the job, right, but here he's saying, you know, my real intention is to... So, and here also we can ask the same question. And God doesn't care about Aaron's feelings? You care more about Aaron's feelings than God does. You're more merciful than God is. Right? But a person has to worry about other people's feelings. So why over here God got angry? And how did Moshe Rabbeinu have the right to refuse? There are all different answers. I'm going to tell you what I think, and I think it's 100% true, and I have a little bit of a proof to it. Moshe Rabbeinu did not say no. He immediately said, yes, I'll go. Didn't say in the Torah, he didn't have a choice. Like, you know, it's an offer that you can't refuse. God said you're going, you're going. What, did you argue with him? So what did Moshe Rabbeinu, what was all this 7 days of bickering? Not that he was questioning whether he should go. He wanted to understand, why, Taka? In my estimation, I'm not the right one. Explain to me why I am. In my estimation, they're not ready to be redeemed. Explain to me why they are. I accept the fact that you know better than I do, but I'd like to understand it. And that is not something that is awesome. People think that, you know, you should do blindly, and that's the big mila, nasa v'nishma, right? We said we'll do, and we'll hear, we'll listen. Then we said we're not making our commitment to do dependent on our understanding. It's not a prerequisite. We'll do it whether we understand it or not. But people forget that there's still a nishma. They didn't just say nasa. They got two crowns, one for the nasa, one for the nishma. Meaning, once you accept to do it, not dependent on your understanding, then there's an inyan to understand as much as you can. The understanding can't be the prerequisite for doing, but it definitely adds to what you're doing if you understand what you're doing. The more you understand, the more quality you can do. And that's the Meiri says this on a pasuk. Tuv tam vadas lamdeni ki b'mitzvosecho ha'emanti. God, I want you to teach me understanding and tam and reasons because I believe in the mitzvahs. I'm not asking you to explain it to me so I should believe in it. It's not a prerequisite. I believe in it anyway. I'm going to do it anyway. But I'd like to understand what I'm doing because doing it with understanding enhances what I'm doing. It's not a prerequisite to do it. I'll do it anyway. But after you accept to do it, there's an inyan to understand as much as you can. A person should understand. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, I'm going to go. But I'd like to understand, why me? Why are they ready? What's your name? What name am I going with? And so on. My proof to this is the following. If Moshe Rabbeinu really was trying to get out of it, okay, then the order of the arguments doesn't make any sense. What did Moshe Rabbeinu say? I don't think I'm the one to go, and I don't think they're ready to be redeemed. That means, let's call off this deal. Okay? It's not the time. I disagree with you, God. You think it's the time to redeem them. You think I'm the one. I'm not the one, and even if I was the one, it's not time because they're not ready. Okay, so that's to get out of the thing. Then, next thing he says, okay, I'm going to go to them. They're going to ask me, what's your name? What's your name? That means he's already accepted to go. It's just now he wants to know the details. Okay, next thing he says, after God tells him his name, he says, you know, but I don't know how to talk. So I don't really think I'm the one. You just said you're going. What he should have done is first say, I don't think I'm the one altogether. Then God says, I'll be with you. He said, yeah, but I can't talk. All to get out of it. Once that doesn't work, then, okay, if I'm going already, what's your name? That should be the order, right? You've tried everything to get out of it, doesn't work. So now you're going to go. Now you ask the details. But first, you're not going. Then you're asking the details. Then you're not going again. The order doesn't seem to make any sense. But that's only if he's trying to get out of it. But if he says, I'm going anyway, I just want to understand, then he tried to understand the more important things first and the less important things second. Then the order can make sense. It doesn't make sense if he's trying to get out of it. It doesn't make sense if he's trying to understand it. So then why did God get angry at the end? Because you can question why you. Why me? Why am I the one? Why are the Jewish people ready? Right? You can understand everything about your mission, but you have no right to ask why not somebody else. Your mission depends on your understanding it fine. But why not our own? That's his business. Let him ask that question. That's not your question. You can ask everything to understand so it will enhance your doing. Questioning God, how come you didn't send him? That's not a question that I need to know because it enhances my action. That's a question that, hey God, I'd like to know how come you decided this. That's a question on God. That question you don't ask. You want to understand your mission fine. Why not him? That's not your business. That's not a question to ask. Have trust that I know what I'm doing. You want to understand what you're doing? Fine. But why not somebody else? Who cares? What do you care? That's my business. It's not your business. That's why the Rabban should get angry at that. Okay.